Hello, my name is Bruce Eater, and I'd like to welcome you to this special Criterion edition of Goldfinger. For the next 111 minutes, I'll be joined by director Guy Hamilton, editor Peter Hunt, designer Ken Adam, and screenwriter Richard Maybaum as we discuss the making of Goldfinger. Goldfinger was the definitive James Bond feature, the film in which the series hit its stride and the movie with which most of the public was first introduced to the world of James Bond. That includes this famed gun barrel logo. Incidentally, that's stunt director Bob Simmons, not Sean Connery, in the gun sight. It leads into a pre-credit sequence which, itself, embodied all of the changes overtaking the series and provided a foretaste of the entire series to come. The previous two James Bond movies, Dr. No and From Russia with Love, had been straight espionage thrillers that didn't take too many risks or veer very far from reality. They had jokes amid the danger, but not much overt fun, and no overt winking at the audience. But that changed with this pre-credit sequence, which is adapted from a reminiscence by Bond at the opening of Ian Fleming's book. It takes chances that were not taken in either of the two prior films. It mixes fun and danger. The seagull camouflage of Bond's is the giveaway. Audiences inevitably laughed when they realized almost instantly what was going on up on the screen, but the laughter didn't break the spell. The gag was so potent that it was reused 26 years later in License to Kill, in a scene in which a villain scanning the ocean floor with a camera ignores an innocent-looking manta ray, from which Bond's scuba fins suddenly stick out. Now we're back to the serious business of espionage. This sequence looks exciting but quite ordinary in the 1990s, but one must realize that writer Richard Maybaum and director Guy Hamilton were communicating a great deal of what was essentially arcane information to the viewer in 1964. Apart from the very luxurious interior of what was essentially a fuel storage tank, this is an example of the dazzle factor of the Bond movies that is unique. Most movies would dwell on those surroundings, but here they are just breezed by on the way to something bigger. Then there was the whole notion of plastic explosives. Most people outside of the ordnance industry in 1964 had no inkling of what they were, or what this material that Bond squeezes out of this tube, rather like toothpaste, was supposed to be. The timer that he sets is the only giveaway, confirmed by the spectacular explosion a few seconds later. Then there is the further tweaking of the audience, which again was new to the series, in which Bond removes his wetsuit to reveal a perfect dinner jacket with carnation underneath. The number of outrages to the audience's sense of reality in these first 2 minutes of action are phenomenal, yet Guy Hamilton pulls it off by virtue of pacing and help from Peter Hunt's editing, an excellent John Barry score, some rather lovely velvety textured photography by Ted Moore, and Connery's smooth performance. None of it holds up to analysis for a moment, but the audience's disbelief has been willingly and happily suspended. Hamilton had a very specific goal in mind for this sequence, which he talks about.
I think the best ever pre-credit sequence was in a James Mason movie called Rommel Desert Fox. I was always trying to top it. To tell a complete story in 4 minutes, and above all, set the mood of the picture. It's a real challenge. I'm saying to the audience, if this makes you laugh, if this amuses you, the interior of an oil tank furnished like a suite at the Plaza, incredible gadgets, if this surprises you, good. We've got plenty more from that where that came from. So sit back, relax, don't ask too many questions, and together we'll go off on a glorious adventure. The sequence must also satisfy Harry Saltzman's passion for gadgets and Cubby's insistence on a generous quota of pretty ladies.
It all wasn't easy to achieve, as editor Peter Hunt tells us about this reflection in a golden eye.
It was an optical, and, of course, for a long while, it looked like it would never work. So he had no courage in the fact that that would work. But we made it work. I think when we came to do her eye, it was very bloodshot or something, I can remember. Or it may have been her eye, I'm not sure. And we did the close-up of the eye, then took the piece of film where he comes out from behind the cupboard and like that, and purely superimposed it optically. In the laboratories. It was really done by a special effects man at Pinewood, Cliff Cully.
The assassin with whom Bond is grappling is portrayed by Alf Joint, one of England's busier stuntmen, while the fight itself was choreographed by Bob Simmons to its celebrated conclusion.
Shocking.
You see, that's absolutely impossible. If you did that, it wouldn't work. He wouldn't electrocute anybody. Shocking, he says. Quite shocking, I remember. Well, they loved it anyway, so it obviously worked. This was Brown John because this was the same sort of thing as From Russia With Love. This was the projection. He developed this style of using a projector with the images from the film onto real people. These were images from the film, you see, which he put right in the front, but he did them on a leg or on a face or as you can see.
Goldfinger was the first of the Bond movies for which John Barry wrote the title song as well as the background music. The lyrics were authored by Leslie Bricusse and Anthony Newley. The song Goldfinger is a far cry from the relatively nondescript title song of From Russia With Love by Lionel Bart. Some elements of Barry's music recall Moon River, but the tempo, accents, and orchestration make this tune leap off the screen. The wailing brass in the opening of the film, and the archly enunciated delivery by Shirley Bassey, who would subsequently sing Diamonds Are Forever and Moonraker, turned this into everything a title song is supposed to do and more. It even merges with the James Bond theme in the finale. Not difficult, but easier to do if the same man writes both. It was a major hit during 1964, rising to number 8 on the Billboard charts and turning the soundtrack album of Goldfinger into the first musical hit of the series. The girl painted gold in this sequence, by the way, is Margaret Nolan, who plays Dink, Bond's masseuse, in the Miami Beach sequence. If you look closely at these images being shown on Nolan's exquisite form, by the way, you'll see that they're a bit of a cheat because they actually contain some footage from Russia With Love. But now let's hear from Guy Hamilton and the way he came to be involved in Goldfinger following Terence Young, who had directed Dr. No and From Russia With Love.
Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman were old acquaintances of mine long before they joined up and became partners. Separately, we talked about many projects, and I was very happy when Cubby sent me the script of Dr. No. I rather fancied the sunshine in Jamaica, but sadly had to stay in wet London to settle some personal affairs. I think Cubby thought I was declining because of some of the more outrageous and cornball sequences in the script. "Don't worry, Dick Maybaum's coming over to fix them," said Cubby. "Whatever you do, don't. That's half the charm of Bond." Cubby remembered that, and that's why I got called in to do Goldfinger, I think. This was the first day shooting on Goldfinger. Ken Adam, the production designer, Ted Moore, the cameraman, and I flew down from New York to Miami on the 15th of January 1964, picked up a local camera crew, and off we went to the Fontainebleau Hotel. Ted is operating in the helicopter, I'm at the opposite end of the swimming pool, and as the chopper comes round, I'm cueing the high diver to take off. All fairly tricky stuff because I had no actors, with the exception of Felix Leiter. So we're shooting mainly with doubles, doing long shots, back projection plates, above all working out what bits and pieces of set we're going to build back in Pinewood Studios to tie up the sequence. When the unit consists of 6 bodies, things move quickly and easily.
Canadian actor Cees Linder became the second man to play Bond's CIA friend, Felix Leiter. Guy Hamilton explains.
Jack Lord, who played Leiter in Dr. No, had gone on to better things in Hawaii and had to be replaced. I knew Cees Linder, who lived in London, and was very much my idea of Felix Leiter. He happened to be in the States at the time, so it made it even simpler still to engage him. No air travel, no accommodation allowance, the producers would love that. We were very mean with actors. All the money goes on special effects and sets.
Letting the opposition get that close to you.
They got a lot closer to you in Jamaica, didn't they? Well, what's on your mind? I'm on holiday.
Not anymore, you're not. Signal from London.
These Miami Beach sequences, for all their seeming simplicity, were among the most difficult to assemble shots in the film. As Guy Hamilton explained, he only had Cece Linder and another Canadian actor, Austin Willis, who plays Mr. Simmons, Goldfinger's Mark, available to him in Miami. Sean Connery didn't begin work until the picture had already been shooting for several weeks. Connery's first day of shooting was the scene in the El Scorpio nightclub seen after the explosion in the pre-credits sequence. The Miami location scenes, as well as the car chase in Goldfinger's Swiss compound, were shot using doubles, with all of the Connery and Gert Frobe scenes being done weeks later on a set designed by Ken Adam at Pinewood Studios in London. Strangely enough, Cece Linder was originally signed to play the part of Mr. Simmons, and Austin Willis, seen here greeting Goldfinger, was to play Leiter, but a last-minute switch reversed their roles. Cece Linder was well known to both British and Canadian audiences at the time, both from stage work and British television. He was born in Poland and raised in Ontario, and after service in the Royal Canadian Air Force, worked as a sports commentator before turning to acting. He played Queeg in the BBC's version of the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial, and also starred in the BBC serial Quatermass and the Pit. On American television, he's appeared in the daytime drama The Secret Storm. His other feature films include Innocent Bystanders and Louis Malle's Atlantic City. These shots are a mixture of location footage, back projection, and Ken Adams' set, and they don't match at all. But they get the job done, with help from Guy Hamilton and a lot more help from Peter Hunt. The mixture of opulence and the rushed look to this scene point up one of the problems in making James Bond a reality. Guy Hamilton.
Only Bond producers would build a hotel corridor and a suite, never used again, just for two shots. It's not really as wasteful as it looks. It is this concept of never going back to a set you've seen, never using the same set twice, that gives a picture its relentless drive, always something new to look at. That's Bondian. I'd staged the Jill Masterson balcony scene with doubles in Miami, which in turn gave me the tricky angles for the plates. Ken reproduced the balcony in studio down to the last nail, so it became just a case of lying back and enjoying it.
Peter Hunt found this anything but enjoyable.
It was a very unfocused beginning, this whole movie, and the whole idea of card playing and him listening to his person in the room, giving him the advice through binoculars. I suspect that Guy Hamilton didn't even believe it and was not at all sure that it would work. I don't know what he really thought, but I don't think he thought it could work. So I had to then, after it had been shot and in order to make it work, do a lot of inserts of the cards and card playing, which I did, and change the construction of him listening to the fall guy in his room. I mean, the sequence didn't work when we got it back, but you have to realize that we started shooting on location, so they were way out on location, and the dailies were coming back, but they were always delayed, and there was not time to go there and reshoot it. And I think we had already planned to do part of the shots as back projection and on the stage. So it was felt quite reasonably that we would adjust it or put it to rights or do whatever we had to do with the sequence when we came back into the studio. Unfortunately, for my eye, you can see that the entire sequence is made up of inserts. But there are a lot of inserts in this film. Never mind, that works. As long as it works, it's good.
This is a good chance to talk about Shirley Eaton, one of the most extraordinarily beautiful actresses ever to work in a James Bond movie, which is saying a great deal. Eaton was a veteran actress who had been appearing in movies since she was 16 years old, and had spent 11 years playing nice girls in light comedies. At the point she was hired for Goldfinger, she had become a minor star in England for her appearances in three of the Peter Rogers-produced Carry On movies, and was eager to make the jump to major stardom, something she found impossible to do in British pictures, where there were no good roles for women. On a promotional tour of the U.S. for Goldfinger in 1964, she told a reporter why she took the small role of Jill Masterson. "I wanted to attract attention so I could get into American films, and this was the best way to do it." Sean Connery, by contrast, wasn't really anxious to do Goldfinger. His acting range had grown enormously since the first two Bond movies, and after From Russia with Love, he'd done Woman of Straw, a thriller with Rafe Richardson and Gina Lola Brigida, and Alfred Hitchcock's Marnie. He suspected that Goldfinger would be even more successful than the first two, and was concerned about being permanently typed in the role of 007. He wanted new terms from Saltzman and Broccoli. The lovemaking here, by the way, is interrupted by the first of the series' double entendre jokes, which would become less subtle in the 1970s.
No, look, I'm sorry. I can't. Something big's come up.
Right.
How about breakfast?
Okay.
Not too early.
I'll call you around 9.
Connery had said publicly in February of 1964, a month before shooting began, that he was reluctant to do the new movie, throwing Saltzman and Broccoli into a panic. He did report, however, under the multi-picture contract he had signed for Dr. No, but it was during the shooting of this scene that his dispute with the producers seems to have come to a head, according to a story told by Tom Carlyle, the film's publicist, to Connery biographer Kenneth Passingham. I'm going to interrupt myself, however, because we're getting a reintroduction of suspense, which is done in a very stylish and unusual way. Viewers in 1964, before karate and kung fu were household names, had to be wondering, what in the hell is that? This whole scene is a masterstroke, adapting an event that Ian Fleming never describes. The only question is, where did Oddjob come from? But audiences don't notice that. They see the ominous shadow and are left to the grisliest imaginations what Jill is thinking as Oddjob approaches. The comparative restraint here probably made it easier to finesse the scene which follows, which had to be handled very carefully. There were censor problems with this scene, which were finally dealt with using a very strategically placed cushion in the long shot. But getting back to Connery, according to Passingham, when the scene of the karate blow was shot, Connery complained of an injury and headache and went home for the day. When he returned, he had a new contract giving him an increase in pay and a percentage of the picture. But now back to poor Jill, gilded in gold paint, as it were. This image of Jill Masterson became the center of Goldfinger's publicity campaign and the most enduring single image of the entire James Bond series. Shirley Eaton's attempt to attract attention succeeded beyond her wildest dreams. Her picture adorned the cover of Life magazine and reappeared in hundreds of other places during the fall and winter of 1964. This was quite a coup for an actress whose biggest picture until then was Carry On Nurse, as well as for Saltzman and Broccoli. Eaton actually was painted gold, not only for the scene itself, but for a photo opportunity with reporters. But the producers naturally took precautions, as Peter Hunt remembers.
We didn't paint her all over, we only painted the back of her, I believe. But if you do paint somebody all over, you've got to leave a spot for them to, the skin to breathe through. So I don't think it was a pleasurable instance. It was done quite quickly. They painted her over, you know, having got it all ready beforehand, so that, in fact, it was a minimum amount of time.
Incidentally, viewers may want to go back to the Jill Masterson death scene with the M&E track activated in order to listen to John Barry's score without the dialogue. Barry has a way with percussion and timbral effects that sticks with the viewer. The triangle clanging away over the vision of Jill's body drives that image into the viewer like a hammer knocking in a nail. Compare the music throughout Goldfinger with that of From Russia with Love, and you find him experimenting with sound in some surprisingly sophisticated ways. In the earlier film, he experiments a lot with strings and percussion, while here he does more with brasses, and he makes leitmotifs and effects out of as little as a clanging triangle for the gilded body of a beauty that Bond has just made love to. Perhaps this isn't exactly Wagner's Liebestod, but it is an element of the early Bond films that is often overlooked, and it is these memorable little bits of associative music that are missed in the non-Barry-scored Bond movies, even the better later ones, such as For Your Eyes Only. Barry's facility with this kind of distinctive shorthand is a result of his background in small group jazz and in television scoring, where composers must make relatively limited musical forces go a long way. On Goldfinger, however, he also has an opportunity to work with a large orchestra at length, and later in the picture, during the Fort Knox sequences, comes up with some of the most memorable incidental music of the entire series.
Well, what
about tonight? You come around.
The repartee between Bond and Moneypenny here was the last that would take place in M's office for the next two pictures. Obviously, the producers knew that the audience was expecting it, but it was necessary to keep it fresh and yet the same. Fresh and yet the same, that became the challenge for the Bond movies after Goldfinger in almost every department. In Thunderball, Bond and Moneypenny tease each other by phone, while in You Only Live Twice, he meets M and his secretary aboard a submarine. And in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, we meet M and Moneypenny before we meet Bond to set the scene, because we're meeting a new James Bond in George Lazenby. The Bank of England briefing was one of the stranger scenes in Goldfinger, if only for the way it's handled, as Peter Hunt explains.
It was the wrong way round, dramatically. If anything, it should have gone into the more... Eventually, I have to cut into it. So to start there on the chief of the Bank of England and pull all the way back just to show that room was very pretentious.
Yes.
Because you've got to get back into the scene again. But for an audience, this was great, I think, because it ended with him showing a gold block, which I'm sure the majority of people, certainly at that time, hadn't seen. I guess by now they've done it so much on television and in other films that audiences have seen it.
This briefing is nicely concise and informative, unexpectedly so, really, because most movies would be content to state the problem as one of smuggling and leave it to the audience to guess the details and motivations. But the scene here is largely based on a scene from Fleming's book and reflects a fascination that the writer found with gold. The actor playing Colonel Smithers of the Bank of England, by the way, is Richard Vernon, a British stage and character actor who should be especially familiar to fans of the Beatles, because he gave them the first snappy comeback of their screen careers. In the opening minutes of A Hard Day's Night, he plays the stuffy gentleman in their railway compartment who complains, "I fought the war for your sort," to which Ringo replies, "I bet you sorry you won." His character here is only slightly more tolerant of James Bond.
As yet, we have failed to discover how he transfers his gold overseas. And Lord knows we've tried.
Richard Maybaum used the scene from the novel and added the detail of the gold bar that Bond is given as bait for Goldfinger. Production designer Ken Adam.
This is the first time we see an actual gold bar. Now, I had gone to the Bank of England. Of course, they wouldn't trust me with a gold bar. But we made these out of lead. And then used actually an American process, which is of metallizing. It's like doing mirror finishes. And so the gold bar had an enormous weight, but obviously wasn't gold.
You'll draw it from Q Branch.
And now to Q Branch and the introduction of the James Bond Aston Martin DB5. Guy Hamilton has very vivid memories of this scene and how it changed James Bond forever.
I was always convinced Q hated Bond. I mean, after all, he never pays attention, mistreats his gizmos, never brings them back. That's how I directed the scene, and that brings us to the Aston Martin. Bond needs a car to get from A to D, and Q's fixed it up. What with? Anybody ideas? Anybody got any ideas? Front machine guns behind the headlights. Well, obvious. What else? I'd just been given a parking ticket, and as I watched the smug little meter maid walk away from my ancient Bentley, I fantasized revolving number plates. That's it. Along came Ben-Hur type chariot wheels, smoke, and oil. I put the problem to my 12-year-old son. "Ejector seat," said he. He was very keen on aeroplanes at the time. Like Topsy, the car just grew. Two, actually. One we paid for, the other Aston Martin gave us to cut up and play with. Sadly, they never really understood what tremendous PR we could do for them, and in no time, Bond was driving other makes. The scene, as scripted, ends with Q saying, "Revolving number plates, and now if I can have your undivided attention for an hour or so," and Bond yawning. I wanted the audience to guess what the other goodies the car would reveal in the course of time, hoping that they would laugh and clap as each wonder was revealed, climaxing in the ejector seat, when all of a sudden Cubby appeared on the set, and asked me to continue the scene with Q demonstrating or pointing out every single feature. I thought this was crass, as it would spoil all surprise for the audience. But I wasn't going to argue, as all this new dialogue could very neatly be dropped on the cutting room floor at a later date. I sat down and wrote. Poor Q is saying, I can't learn all that in 10 minutes. It's naturally 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. Somehow we scrambled through, and I learnt a great lesson. Cubby was absolutely right. Tell them what you're going to do, and then do it. Audience's reaction proved it, and I've always been grateful to him.
Eject a seat.
Eject a seat? You're joking.
I never joke about my work, 007.
I'd been playing golf on and off for a number of years, and Dick Maybaum was a distinguished hacker like myself, so we set about the golf sequence with great relish. We had to stay within the strict rules of golf, and yet at the same time make the scene understandable and enjoyable to anyone who'd never seen a golf ball in their lives. I think it more or less works. Goldfinger we doubled, but Sean took a few lessons, and so we could show him swinging. I think it was the start of a lifelong love affair with the noble art, as far as he was concerned.
This is both Bonds and our first formal meeting with Goldfinger and Oddjob, shot during the spring of 1964 at the Stoke Pogues Country Club. Fleming himself was an avid golfer, and his account of the golf game in Goldfinger is one of the most engaging parts of the book. While the game is condensed down to two holes on the screen, we can hear from Guy Hamilton and Peter Hunt about Gert Frobe and some of the problems that the language barrier presented.
Cubby'd shown me a German film starring Gert Frobe as a child molester. I thought he was rather splendid. And on being assured that his English was more than adequate, he was signed up. As it transpired, it was adequate to say good morning and goodbye, and that's about it. Dear Gert had worked very hard and learnt his part by rote with the aid of a dialogue coach, but it was obvious we'd have to revoice him. But that's not where the trick lay. An actor playing in a language other than his own is, of course, forced to slow down, enunciate carefully as he tries to get his tongue round unfamiliar sounds, and all tempo goes out of the scene. If you allow the actor to keep up that rhythm, then even Laurence Olivier revoicing him will send you to sleep because he can only follow the lip movements. Faster, Gert, quicker. When Cubby and Harry saw the dailies, they went ape. Goldfinger was speaking total gibberish, but the lip speed allowed us to dub at the right tempo. That was the trick, and that's how it works.
Of course, a lot of people don't realize that I had to revoice completely. We revoiced completely Goldfinger. Which I did with a radio actor, a man called Michael Collins, whom I cast for just the voice. Unfortunately, Gert, who spoke considerable, I mean, his knowledge of English was great, his pronunciation of English was poor, and they felt that a lot of him was not understandable. So I very carefully and diligently, over a period of like 2-3 weeks, completely revoiced him with this man, Michael Collins, who did a superb work. It was a very tedious job, but it had to be done. And in fact, I defy anybody to know in advance that that was the case. There is a secret about revoicing, and that is you must get an actor to play the voice with the same timbre, with the same sounding voice as the actor that you're revoicing or the actress that you're revoicing. You can't just throw anybody in there and do it. So I did a casting of a number of actors. I've done it before and I've done it since a number of occasions. Very, very successful. In fact, one famous actress didn't even know that she was revoiced and she came to the premiere. But that was just by being careful and being diligent about it and doing it very professionally. You know, there's nothing more infuriating than having as we've all done, sitting through a film and having an actor in the film that you can't quite understand. It becomes irritant.
Let's have a little fun with Mr. Goldfinger.
The golf game gives us a chance to talk about Gert Frobe, who was arguably the best of the James Bond villains. Karl Gerhard Frobe was born in Zwickau, Saxony in 1913, the son of a rope maker. He was a violin prodigy as a boy, but had a keener interest in art and made his introduction to theater in the mid-1930s as a stage decorator. He made his acting debut on stage in 1937. In an interview shortly after Goldfinger opened, Frobe freely admitted to becoming a Nazi party member in 1929 in the belief, as a 16-year-old whose village was desperately impoverished, that Hitler could provide a solution to economic distress. During the war, he did serve as a non-commissioned officer in the German army occupying Vienna. But in Frobe's defense, he did befriend a family during this period whose members consisted of a non-Jewish father and a Jewish mother and their son. When the father was arrested by the Gestapo and sent to a concentration camp, the son escaped while Frobe allowed the mother, named Stella Blumenau, to hide in his unoccupied apartment in Vienna. Following the German surrender in 1945, Frobe was banned from working and was investigated by the Allied authorities. In all the confusion accompanying the four-power occupation of the city, the one witness who could have cleared him, Stella Blumenau, was nowhere to be found. Finally, after almost a year of forced inactivity and despair, a Viennese rabbi contacted Frobe with news that Stella Blumenau had been found. She confirmed his story for the authorities, and Frobe was given a clean bill of health. Unfortunately, when word of Frobe's interview got back to Israel, where a newly passed law forbade the showing of films with former Nazis as participants, Goldfinger, which had been doing round-the-clock business in Tel Aviv, was immediately closed down. The whole story of Frobe's past threatened to fester as the international press seized upon it, until the Israeli authorities took a look at the record of the post-war investigation of Frobe, and Stella Blumenau's son came forth to defend him, and they ruled that he had been fully exonerated. The movie reopened to tremendous success, and the matter was soon forgotten. Frobe went on to appear in many international productions afterward, including the Saltzman Broccoli adaptation of Ian Fleming's children's book Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, where he played a villain with the surprisingly Bondian name of Baron Bomburst. The heroine of that film, by the way, also had the delectable Fleming name of Truly Scrumptious. I'll get back to Frobe's career a little later, but we're about to get a new demonstration of Oddjob's physical capabilities and the Aston Martin in action. Editor Peter Hunt and director Guy Hamilton talk a bit about these scenes, which were very problematic.
This is when Oddjob shows his skills. This is a piece of my work, because what they did was to shoot this with him just throwing it out of screen. And I don't know what they ever thought. That I shot. That was all shot by the director, and there he throws it out of screen. But I had to do all that and that, and that part of it. But all they did was just have him throw it out of screen. I don't quite know what they thought was going to happen. I mean, you knew that you had to show the strength of this man and what this man was going to be and do in the film. It was all part of scripting it, I think, and setting up the character.
Sean thought that was ridiculous. Nobody could squash a golf ball. But that's the whole point, Sean. It's obvious by now that before the picture's over, you and Oddjob are going to tangle. So you're going to be fighting a man who can squash golf balls, amongst other things. I still say it's rubbish. It'll end up on the cutting room floor.
I come into play here. In those days they used to say, give it to Pete Arndt, he'll shoot it. Give him all the inserts. Well, that I shot, they were all done really on a special effects stage. You know, they were not particularly ingenious. I guess they were the first time that they were shown that he was able to trace where, because he'd put the bleeper in the car and all that. And now they sell them to the public to follow stolen cars with and things like that. It's nothing now, but in those days it was, I guess, and we've forgotten.
While Bond pursues his quarry, there's time to talk a bit more about Gert Frobe. He is wonderful as a Bond villain because he's so physically imposing, but also a good actor. In fact, he was a relatively slender man during his early adult life. What happened was that his wife's cooking fattened him up and made him into the Sidney Greenstreet type character that the world came to know. He appeared in the 1955 film Orson Welles' Mr. Arcadian and played the German sergeant patrolling the beach when the Allied invasion begins in The Longest Day. The film that won him the title role in Goldfinger, however, was a 1958 German movie directed by Ladislav Vaja called It Happened in Broad Daylight, about a child murderer in a small village. After Goldfinger, Froebe worked in the blockbuster Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines and portrayed General von Koltitz in Is Paris Burning? He was still working in the 1980s in pictures that included Ingmar Bergman's The Serpent's Egg. He was a very important and popular actor in Germany and had been invited to appear on the jury of the 1988 Berlin Film Festival, but illness prevented it. He died of a heart attack in Munich in 1988. These scenes were shot outside of Andermatt in Switzerland and give Goldfinger its international flavor, but they were also among the firsts in Goldfinger. Shot in 1964, Goldfinger was the first feature film to mention the Beatles in the earlier Jill Masterson scenes, and here it was the first time the brand new Ford Mustang driven by Tilly Masterson was ever used in a movie. Peter Hunt and Guy Hamilton talk about the cars, these scenes, and the players. Peter Hunt.
Fords were very good to us, so probably the producers had a deal with Fords. I know that Ford's provided us with a lot of car material, probably free of charge, in order to show their cars.
Guy Hamilton.
I remember taking a weekend off from scripting and dashing about all over Switzerland to find a road with a series of hairpin bends so that I could shoot the double pullback on a zoom lens, which I thought would be a rather smart way of not revealing the identity of the sniper. I rather like it. Correct use of the zoom lens, I think.
Tanya Mallett was the name of that girl. Tilly Masterson. Tanya Mallett. I don't know what happened to her. She wasn't a great actress, I'm afraid. She needed a lot of encouragement. But she was a pretty girl. Very pretty girl. Nice girl. I don't know what happened to her. Probably got married and had a big family.
Tanya Mallett was, according to Guy Hamilton, a discovery of Harry Saltzman's, and he put her into the picture as Jill Masterson's vengeful sister, Tilly. Her role is a small but pivotal one. Now the Aston Martin goes into action. Peter Hunt.
Aston Martins were always the bane of Broccoli's life. Cubby Broccoli always swore. Of course, they had to buy them. They had to pay for them. They were not given them by any means. And I think it was Aston Martin's a very good car, and it was considered to be, a very tasty, expensive type car of the time. This thing coming out of the wheel is done on the special effects stage with the wheel going round, and the reverse is against a BP. That's back projection. I doubt that a lot of these sequences would work today if you did it in a film. I think the public would expect more out of a film of today's calibre, because it has all been done again and again, and in many cases very much better.
The character of Tilly Masterson really isn't defined at all. In Fleming's book, she becomes the would-be lover of Pussy Galore, who in the book is a very tough lesbian gang leader. With her offhanded manner, however, Tanya Mallett does give the screenwriters the chance for a humorous variation on James Bond's now standard introductory line.
As quickly as possible. I'll take that.
Yes, of course. What's your name, by the way?
Soames. Tilly Soames.
Here for the hunting season? I had a case just like that one.
It's for my ice skates.
Lovely sport. And where do you skate?
St. Moritz.
I didn't know there was ice there this time of the year.
There's a garage.
The writing here is drawn from Fleming's book, although the line about San Moritz is new. It adds a certain international flavor to the proceedings and is also perhaps a quiet acknowledgement by screenwriter Richard Maybaum to Alfred Hitchcock, for whom he had once worked. Hitchcock's classic Man Who Knew Too Much involves an assassination attempt by a sharpshooter set against a skating and skiing season at San Moritz. Maybaum is often overlooked by Bond fanatics, many of whom are so intrigued by the actors and the hardware that they forget about the writing that goes into the films, particularly the classic original three, plus On Her Majesty's Secret Service and a handful of the subsequent movies. Maybaum and Terence Young originally worked on the script to Goldfinger together, until Young left the production when Saltzman and Broccoli rejected his demand for a percentage of the picture. Young was replaced as Maybaum's collaborator by Paul Dean, a former drama and film critic from Manchester, England. He had previously won an Oscar for the screenplay for one of England's best post-war thrillers and the first thriller ever involving nuclear weapons, 7 Days to Noon. He also won a British Oscar for his script for the 1958 thriller Orders to Kill. His post-Goldfinger credits include The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, Night of the Generals, and The Taming of the Shrew, as well as all 4 sequels to Planet of the Apes. Dean, according to most analyses, was principally responsible for the humor of the script. Maybaum, as was his tendency, was best at doing stylish but fairly straightforward drama and action scripts. From Russia with Love was his pride and joy, but he knew that Goldfinger, with its more pronounced humor and sexuality, was the picture where Bond was defined as a film phenomenon. These scenes, by the way, were shot at the Paletus Aircraft Factory in Switzerland, which in the long shots is doubling as Auric Enterprises. The close-ups were done at Pinewood Studios in England, and with the car chase were among the first sequences shot. Guy Hamilton.
We started shooting the picture on March the 9th. I started with a car chase with doubles at night around the sound stages of Pinewood Studios, because Sean was finishing off a picture with Hitchcock in the States. A few days later, he joined us, and we broke him in gently, running about, clambering up ladders, etc. I'm always amazed that nobody hoots with laughter at these crazy Koreans running around in blue coveralls, yellow and black sashes, little white socks, swarming all over a pretty Swiss village, a stud farm in Kentucky, around Fort Knox area, without drawing the slightest reaction from the locals.
What is interesting about these scenes, but completely lost to 2 generations of viewers who have seen Goldfinger many times over, is that at this point in the movie, as in the book, Bond and the audience are still concentrating on what is essentially a smuggling case. The melting down of Goldfinger's 1937 Rolls-Royce Phantom III is the giveaway and the solution to the case. Incidentally, that car, as seen and driven earlier in the film, sold for more than $120,000 at auction in 1986, while Bond's Aston Martin sold for over $250,000 the same year. At this point in the book, and no doubt in Bond's mind on the screen, he has just broken the case for the Bank of England and is anticipating going back to report action by the British government to freeze Goldfinger's assets, a trial in one of the smuggling courts, and a few years in prison for Goldfinger. With 2 notable exceptions, this root in reality, in the actual function of intelligence services, and the reality behind Fleming's original character, is a plot element of the Bond movies that was lost after Goldfinger. In the main Bond series that followed, up to but not including the 2 Timothy Dalton films, Bond would never again start off with so interesting but seemingly mundane a villain as Auric Goldfinger. From here on, he would deal almost entirely with superhuman, super-ambitious villains whose plans involve far more than just making a lot of money. The main exception to this was For Your Eyes Only, a script that was written by Richard Maybaum based on an Ian Fleming story. Maybaum, who died in February of 1991, soon after being interviewed about these films, was the member of the Bond team with the most serious credits of any of the original members. Born in New York in 1910, he was originally a law student but escaped to a writing program at the University of Iowa. While still a student, one of his plays, The Tree, an anti-lynching drama, won an award and was produced on Broadway. His subsequent work as a dramatist included Birthright, a pioneering anti-Nazi drama from 1933, and Sweet Mystery of Life, a satire on the insurance business that was bought by Warner Brothers and used as the basis for the plot of the musical, Gold Diggers of 1936. He went on to Hollywood in the late 1930s and worked on such films as Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent, Dive Bomber with Errol Flynn and Fred McMurray, and The Big Clock starring Ray Milland and Charles Laughton. It was through his association with Alan Ladd on movies such as OSS and The Great Gatsby that Maybaum met Cubby Broccoli, when Ladd was signed to make three films in England for Broccoli's Warwick Films. Anyone who knows anything about any of the films I've mentioned will realize that they are extremely solid screenplays. Maybaum understood drama and suspense, and he understood characters, but most of all, he had a phenomenal sense of what good writing in the proper directorial and performing hands could do with an audience. He relished the manipulation of the audience in the Bond films as a challenge, devising the emotional roller coaster that the viewer would ride, and leaving it to the director, whether it was Terence Young, Guy Hamilton, or John Glenn, along with Ken Adam and special effects man John Steers, to operate that roller coaster. The Aston Martin ride here is a perfect example. Maybaum, in conjunction with Hamilton and Steers, have come up with this wonderful car with all of these capabilities that have been announced to the audience in advance, and they're having a ball with it and giving the audience their money's worth. Tilly Masterson is even enjoying the mayhem caused by Bond, the only moment in her brief time on screen that we see her smiling. And then Maybaum brings them back to Earth and returns us to something approaching reality.
Every now and then, you had to, what I call, pull down the balloon and make it realistic again. For instance, when that car that Cube had given him has done its tacks going out and the oil spilling and something blowing up and all those kind of things, and there's been one laugh after another, six or seven laughs, you see, and then suddenly they're blocked and the fun is over, and there stands Oddjob with his revolver, and Bond opens the door and says, "Run." And she runs, and Oddjob shoots her dead. Bond, despite seeing that he's in great jeopardy from the guy with the gun, walks over to where the girl is, knelt down by her, and, no, he didn't shoot her. He took off his hat, Oddjob, didn't he? He threw it, and he hit her in the back of the neck and killed her. A ludicrous way to die. But after all those laughs, there was absolute dead silence. We had pulled down the balloon and killed a real girl in a way that she reasonably, not reasonably, but she could have been killed. And it was the alternation of serious menace and excitement and stuff like that, which made it possible to have your serious moment when you wanted it. And also, because there were many serious moments, you could also have Bond be flippant about them.
Guy Hamilton.
It's surprising what you can get away with if you do it with conviction. Shortly after the picture opened in L.A., Hitchcock invited me to lunch. He'd seen the movie. I don't think he particularly cared for it. But as we parted, he said, "The little old lady at the gate, bowing and scraping, 2 minutes later swinging that machine gun, like that, made my day." Had a feeling he wished he'd thought of it and used it.
Peter Hunt.
I don't think any of the tricks actually worked on the car when it was moving. They were all put there, and they're all cleverly concealed to make it appear as if they worked whilst it was moving. But they were all shot with the car static or with back projection going or in close-up. The ejector seat that was put in there was an ejector seat, and the guy did manage to move up. We had an American guy called Charlie Ruchon who was with Northrop here and was often very much in the forefront of obtaining bits and pieces and things that we needed.
The little old lady gatekeeper is played by actress Varley Thomas, and this touch of having her fire the submachine gun was one of those bits that made the early Bond films so engaging. You just didn't do things like that in movies at the time, unless you were Hitchcock, and then you didn't do it quite so quickly or offhandedly. The audience barely has time to react to her and her presence is felt as an almost subliminal surprise. These sequences were shot at Pinewood Studios before Connery's arrival on the picture, and that stuntman George Leach behind the wheel of the Aston Martin. Peter Hunt has made this segment much more exciting by speeding it up in the lab. Leach actually drove the car through the wall in his first try, and the crash had to be restaged to make it work. Peter Hunt and Guy Hamilton pick up the action.
That's a little insert that I shot on the special effects stage with Cliff Carley.
Now here's something that I screwed up. It doesn't work for me. It's not clear. If it becomes clear, it's too late. Bond is heading down the alley. A car is coming at him head on. It doesn't come to a stop despite machine gun fire. He's about to crash into it. He swerves into the wall to avoid it. There is no car. It's his own headlights reflected in one of those corner mirrors. It's not at all clear. Hate the whole thing. The laser room was Gert Fröber's first day's work. Ian Fleming came down to lunch that day and visited the set. Clearly he was not a well man, but he smoked away with his cigarette holder, a slightly bemused smile, as he watched his brainchild passing into new realms of fantasy. I don't think Fleming ever totally approved the treatment of his books. He thought they were much more serious, but he certainly approved of the success and rewards those films were to bring him. I was always sorry he didn't live to see Goldfinger. I think he might have been amused.
I do have a new toy, but...
Peter Hunt tells us a little bit about the creation of this laser beam, which was the first ever depicted in a major motion picture.
Good scene, this. The best scene in the film, actually. Yes, it's well written, the idea of it is so good and so terrifying. Every man, I think, could be put in the position of having his balls cut off like this with a laser beam. The laser beam was of course an optical again. I think it was put in by Cliff Carley. Now all that is real, with the light flashing and the machine going back, all that has been made to be real. That is an optical. That is done by special effects. And that is done by special effects. That was originally just there without any beam coming down. The flame was put in afterwards. Flame was added to it. You notice too, of course, we don't hold it for that length of time. It's very cleverly manipulated and cut.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration.
Choose your next witness.
We would cut a piece of the metal through and then shoot with it, so that when we put in the optical, you would see that, like the back of that. See, we don't hold it. You just get the illusion that the beam is cutting the metal.
And this is possibly the best dialogue of the entire James Bond series.
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. There is nothing you can talk to me about that I don't already know.
So I had to time all those things without the beam, and then give the piece of film to the special effects and the laboratories so that they then put that in.
You're forgetting one thing. If I fail to report, 008 replaces me.
I trust he will be more successful.
And those are all sound effects that were put on afterwards, too. That goes with what I've previously said. A great deal of care was taken over the sound effects on all these Bond films. And we were given the time to do it. There was a tremendous understanding on the part of the producers that this was a necessary quality of these films. Some of the flame, I think, we put in from underneath. For instance, in those shots, you just see a little bit of the red. Again, it's the pacing of those shots that work, make it work so well.
Production designer Ken Adam.
The design of the actual laser, I again had a technical advisor from the Harvard Atomic Establishment who said this could be. You know, you always have to take all the good things and then use a certain amount of artistic license. But in those days, it was not possible to use or photograph an actual laser beam, so the laser beam eventually was put in optically.
And now we meet the bondwoman with the most memorable name of all, Miss Pussy Galore, played by Honor Blackman. First, Guy Hamilton picks up the story about her name and the problems it caused.
And here is the delectable Miss Pussy Galore. I seem to remember there was a nervousness on the part of producers at the fortunate choice of name. I took the view that Fleming had named her thus, 1 million readers had read it in print, so the censor was really trying to close the stable door long after the horse, etc. But I think it was Tom Carlyle, our 7-foot-tall publicity man, who settled the issue by getting published a picture of Prince Philip and Honor Blackman with the charming caption, Pussy and the Prince.
Peter Hunt.
The censorship story was great here. They sent me across to America to, at that time we had the Catholic censorship, and they knew we were going to have a problem with the name, Pussy Galore. Although it was in the book, I don't know why we should have done, but they were very concerned about whether they would get that by. And the moment I arrived in New York and gave an interview, I immediately mentioned her name and said, well, there's a, you know, great character called Pussy Galore. And that was out, and that was it. And from that time onwards, people talked about it. So when they came to see it on the censor, they'd already heard about the name Pussy Galore. And it had been spoken about by so many people for so much because of the name that I think they were defeated. They were preconditioned to it. So there was never any problem about it after that. Honor Blackman was a very big film star in the early days of rank film. She was quite a big English film star. She came from the group of rank film actors of the style of Eric Portman and Jean Kent and all those. But she was a young girl at that time. And she did a lot of stage work, of course. She was well known as an English actress.
Actually, the American television networks did have trouble with the name Pussy Galore, and when the talk shows ran clips of Goldfinger, either her first name or her last name was used, but not both. And it wasn't just television. Although most of the mainstream print media got into the spirit of the punning name, there was resistance to using it. Variety, in its review, refers to her simply as Pussy, whereas the New York Times, although printing her name in the credits, never refers to her character by name in Bosley Crowther's review. Most amazingly, while magazines like Life had no problem mentioning Pussy Galore by name, Sports Illustrated, of all journals, simply called her Galore. We have a little time now to talk about Honor Blackman. She is one of the few actresses to appear as a bondwoman who has seriously benefited from the experience. The irony was that Blackman, 4 years earlier, had almost given up acting. Her story is almost as interesting as her character, and the two are related very closely for some not obvious reasons. She was a Cockney born in 1926, whose father had tremendous aspirations for his children. The family was very poor, and in 1942, when she was 16, her father gave her a choice. She could get the bicycle that she wanted, or spend the money on speech lessons. He had rightly reckoned that in England, how educated one was mattered a lot less to one's chances of success than how educated one sounded. She chose the speech lessons and continued them after leaving home, and eventually conquered her Cockney accent. Reading led Blackman into acting, and she started taking bit parts in plays on the West End for as little as $20 a week. She was signed up as a contract player with Britain's Rank Film Organization in 1947, and acquitted herself well in the only kinds of roles available to British actresses at the time, patient, dutiful wives. One exception was a 1951 English comedy called Green Grow the Rushes, in which she starred with Richard Burton. She played a woman reporter who uncovers a local smuggling operation. She may have been England's first post-war working feminist, at least in movies. Oh, Guy Hamilton had something to say about this segment coming up, and priming an audience.
Here's a good idea of planting information for a later payoff. Goldfinger is going to be sucked out of an aeroplane to his death. You must assume that 90% of the audience at that time would have no idea about bullets and depressurization. So later, if you played it straight, they would have no idea what was going on.
That's a Smith & Wesson 45. If you fired at this close range, the bullet will pass through me and the fuselage like a blowtorch through butter. The cabin will depressurize and we'll both be sucked into outer space together.
By the end of the 1950s, Blackman's career had slowed to a near standstill owing to a lack of roles suitable to her rapidly maturing, aggressive good looks. In 1960, by her own estimation, she earned only £250, less than $1,000, from her acting. Then lightning struck, in the form of a television series called The Avengers. A casting change during the show's second season led producers to look for a female co-star for Avengers star Patrick McNee, and Blackman got the part of Mrs. Catherine Gale. As conceived, it was an extraordinary part for a woman. Mrs. Gale was an attractive widow with a Ph.D. in anthropology who joined Steed on his various espionage adventures. She was also a judo expert and was quite capable of tossing a man around a room. It was all rather Bondian in itself, but what made it special for Blackman was her suggestion, accepted by the perplexed writers, that they write the part as though it were being written for a man. Blackman's outfits on the show, which ranged from elegant but functional sportswear to black leather bodysuits, completed the picture, and by the end of 1963, she was the most popular actress on British television and an object of adoration for millions of viewers. Broccoli and Saltzman had early on established the concept of casting beautiful but unknown actresses as Bond's love interests in each of the films. Ursula Andress and Daniela Bianchi from Dr. No and from Russia with Love are the prime examples. Blackman was different. She had built up enormous name recognition in England from the Avengers, and as a result was already established there as a sex symbol associated with espionage and adventure. She had the added advantage of being unknown outside of England, for the Avengers had not been sold or shown in the United States or most of the rest of the world. And she was perfect for the screen conception of Pussy Galore. This was a tougher part than either Ursula Andress or Daniela Bianchi had to play in the two earlier Bond movies. Miss Galore is an active player in the plot, she's a pilot, and an aggressive character as well as being a judo expert. In Fleming's original novel, she was a lesbian gang leader, one of the mobsters that Goldfinger ensnares in his plot to rob Fort Knox.
They should be. I trained them. Come on.
The lesbianism is toned down almost to the point of non-existence in the screenplay, except for little lines such as her telling Bond to forget his charm because she's immune. Actually, Blackman wanted to tease the audience with other references, but unlike Terence Young on the two earlier pictures, Guy Hamilton didn't permit much deviation from Goldfinger's script, and he denied her the opportunity to have quite that much fun with the role. Blackman is the most unusual of all the Bond women on a number of counts. For one thing, she's the only actress ever to play a James Bond love interest, if you will, who was older than the man playing Bond. Sean Connery was 33 years old when he did Goldfinger, while Blackman was 38, hardly the pliant and sweet young talents that have passed through the series before or since. For another thing, she's an actress, first and always. The fact that she is extremely attractive didn't hurt her career, but Blackman never entered beauty contests, sent agents or producers pictures of herself in wet t-shirts, or any of the other things that most of the Bond women have done, at least on occasion, on their way to fame. The result of this congruence of abilities on the part of Connery and Blackman made their scenes together the most balanced and interesting of any of the contacts that Bond, in his various guises, has had with any of his female companions. These are two consummate professionals who play the camera for all that it's worth, and there is an electricity between them as performers that is utterly lacking from the rest of the series. Oddly enough, the only other well-known actress ever cast as a Bond love interest was also a graduate from the Avengers, Diana Rigg, who co-starred in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and who was Blackman's successor on the series when she left to do Goldfinger. Along with Jane Seymour from Live and Let Die, they represent the best of the Bond women. Blackman was also one of the few women to appear in a Bond movie who benefited from it as an actress. Goldfinger for her was a second chance at screen stardom, and she used it for all it was worth. The result was a multi-film deal with Broccoli and Saltzman, and plum screen roles in the movies Life at the Top and Moment to Moment. The latter picture, directed by Mervyn LeRoy in 1966, brought her to Hollywood for the first time. Blackman went on to star in the London stage production of Wait Until Dark, her first stage role in 10 years, and has since starred in such plays as The Sound of Music, A Little Night Music, and Agnes of God. And in 1990, at age 64, she got her second hit series as the star of Thames Television's The Upper Hand, the British version of the American series Who's the Boss? Today, Honor Blackman looks back fondly on Goldfinger. She describes Sean Connery, with whom she subsequently did the Western adventure, Shalico, as a complete professional and a very sexy man. Blackman, incidentally, did her own judo and stunt work on Goldfinger. They did have a double standing by for the scene where Bond tosses her into the hay, but she insisted on playing the scene herself. Curiously, she also decided to learn how to fly a plane after playing the part of Pussy Galore. And although she only held an orange belt in judo, she did write a book about judo and self-defense for women that sold very well on both sides of the Atlantic. Oh, and just for the record, Honor Blackman has a husband and two children and a great sense of humor about the part of Pussy Galore, another reason why she's so memorable beyond her name. It's time we got back into the action a bit, especially as we're coming up on one of the best sets that Ken Adam ever designed. You can see what's happening to the Bond movies in this sequence. The scene the set is used for doesn't stand up to analysis for a moment. If Goldfinger is planning to kill the gangsters anyway, then why the elaborate show, except to reveal the plot? Ken Adam.
The idea was Goldfinger had this incredible stud farm in Kentucky, and I knew what was going to happen there, so, you know, I had to incorporate it all into design. The bar rotated, and the gruesome details was that this set was going to become a gas chamber in which all the gangsters were killed. So I designed it in such a way that all the walls could collapse and the fireplace would come down, so there was no escape of or entry of fresh air. The billiard table became a control console, if I remember rightly, turned around and showed the model of Fort Knox.
The Fort Knox robbery is, of course, intended to bedazzle the audience. It is, and this is, the moment the Bond novels broke free of convention and reality completely and entered the realm of fantasy. Covering the books in reverse order, Dr. No, which immediately preceded Goldfinger among the novels, was based on the idea of a man who was trying to destroy America's space launches. Perhaps not reality, but something that could have happened, at least in the mind of the reader in 1958. And Moonraker, with its plot to destroy London with a rogue missile, was all too plausible for Londoners who had endured the German V2 attacks. And apart from their savagery, which today seems tame, none of the events in Live and Let Die or Casino Royale were beyond the realm of possibility. But in Goldfinger, Fleming makes that giant leap to a plan to rob Fort Knox. And, well, for one thing, as the screenwriters realized, it would take 12 days to remove all the gold from Fort Knox, and then where do you go? They sweated long and hard over the subject of why someone would go to all the trouble of breaking into Fort Knox and then not steal anything, and eventually came up with the idea of irradiating the gold to make it valueless, thus increasing the value of Mr. Goldfinger's holdings. Of course, Bond deduces this in the space of a single breath. This is a good opportunity to talk about the plot of Goldfinger, its genesis, and its place within Ian Fleming's literary output. Most viewers, and even many readers today, aren't aware that there were actually two distinctly separate bodies of James Bond novels by Ian Fleming, of which Goldfinger was the second one of the second group. The first group, beginning with Ian Fleming's first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, published in 1953, were less serious as books. Fleming considered them a joke between himself and his relatively small audience, with Bond a fairly vague substitute for himself, a sort of ideal picture of Fleming by Fleming. Even these early books, however, contained a kernel of truth that brought them to life as adventures and not mere travelogues. Casino Royale was a fairly hurried attempt to adapt a reminiscence by Fleming, built around a night he spent in a casino in Lisbon during World War II as a member of British counterintelligence. Live and Let Die, the second, was inspired by his own imaginings about Jamaica, where he kept his summer retreat Goldeneye, and several experiences he'd had traveling around the United States. The third novel, Moonraker, published in 1955, was a little freer in its story, influenced by the growing British fascination with rocketry. It may possibly have evolved indirectly out of an immensely popular BBC presentation of a serial called The Quatermass Experiment, written by Nigel Neal, which had taken England by storm during 1953 with its story of a British rocket launch that goes horribly wrong. But its villain, Hugo Drax, was based on Obersturmbannfuhrer Otto Skorzeny, a German officer responsible for rescuing Mussolini from anti-fascist partisans, about whom Fleming had made a detailed study as an intelligence officer during World War II. In his first Bond novel, Fleming created a violent but lively fiction based on his past as an intelligence operative. In his second, he learned how to adapt Bond to the present and put him into new situations. By 1956, and from Russia with Love, Fleming was ready to experiment with Bond, and the result was the transitional Bond story. Freer, less constricted fiction than he had ever written before, and with a rapidly evolving picture of Bond, From Russia with Love marked the transition point in the series. Fleming became much more serious as he found his experiment in From Russia with Love accepted. He had never made much money from his writing, and sales of his first three books, in the United States in particular, were notably poor. Still, he had the respect of authors as different as Somerset Maugham, Raymond Chandler, Noel Coward, and novelist-poet William Plummer. In 1956, Fleming became involved with a failed attempt at a CBS television series called Commander Jamaica, the script of which became Dr. No. London's Daily Express newspaper paid £3,000, the equivalent of $10,000, a very princely sum in 1957, for the serialization rights to From Russia with Love, and began adapting the Bond novels into a daily comic strip, paying Fleming an additional £1,500 per title. The recognition of Bond's and Fleming's popularity started pouring in. Sales rose, film companies and producers that had previously let options on the books languish became seriously interested in them, and suddenly Bond was somewhat more than a cult. It was against this backdrop that Goldfinger was begun. In April of 1957, Fleming spent 10 days at a health resort called Enton Hall in Surrey, living on a diet of orange juice and tomato soup and receiving steam baths and treatment for a sciatica in a traction machine. Enton Hall became the basis for Shrublands, the resort that Bond is sent to in Thunderball, but it was on his first day there that Fleming met a goldsmith named Guy Welby. Fleming found himself fascinated by the whole subject of gold, and for the next 10 days he eagerly absorbed everything Welby had to say about gold and its qualities. A year later, as he finally began to see the way to success as an author, Fleming began what his biographer, John Pearson, called a personal raid on Fort Knox. He began working on Goldfinger, reacquainting himself with Welby and his knowledge, spending an afternoon with a gold dealer in a smelting room, and meeting with a Bank of England official to learn all of the newest smuggling techniques. Of course, Fleming himself conceived of the character of Auric Goldfinger, a man so enamored of gold that he makes love to it by having a woman painted gold. It fell to Richard Maybaum and Guy Hamilton to translate that literary image to the screen in its most startling fashion. Maybaum was Fleming's best translator to film. He recognized the screen limitations of robbing Fort Knox, and it was Maybaum who altered the near-castration scene from the book. In the novel, Bond is threatened by a buzzsaw, which works fine in literary terms. Maybaum realized that on screen, however, that scene would look too much to theater audiences like something out of The Perils of Pauline, and the laser beam was used instead. It was also while Goldfinger was in the works that Fleming came up with the idea that Bond should drive a customized car. Of course, the Aston Martin DB3 that he conceived only had ramming bumpers, a homing device, and a secret compartment for Bond's gun, and Maybaum and the rest of the production team made it more exciting from there. The movie leaps into fantasy much earlier with the car chase. In fact, there are those who say that the moment James Bond was changed forever on the screen was when the Korean guard is flung from Bond's car in the ejector seat. Guy Hamilton rightly guesses that Ian Fleming felt the Bond movies were too light-hearted and humorous. He was writing in deadly earnest, and in fact one of the flaws of his books, of which he was aware, was their oppressive seriousness of tone and Bond's complete lack of humor. He might well have appreciated Goldfinger, and he certainly did appreciate the £100,000 per picture plus 5% of the producer's profits that his contract with Saltzman and Broccoli brought. though he only in fact lived to see the first two movies finished. But more is the pity that he didn't live to see Thunderball and On Her Majesty's Secret Service on the screen. Thunderball was a distant cousin to Goldfinger in terms of their origin, and Terrence Young is far more restrained in his handling of the material in It than Guy Hamilton is here. And On Her Majesty's Secret Service is arguably the best of the James Bond movies, or at least one on a par with the original four. It is certainly the one truest to the content and spirit of the book it is drawn from, a virtue that can be attributed to Richard Maybaum, who wrote the screenplay, and to Peter Hunt, who directed it. Both were great admirers of that book, among all the Fleming titles. By the time of Diamonds Are Forever, too much had changed in the world to go back to Fleming's originals. Goldfinger became the model for virtually all of the Bonds of the 1970s and early 80s, most notably Diamonds Are Forever. In adapting Fleming's book, which was one of the first group of Bond titles, involving a fairly straightforward but dangerous diamond smuggling caper, Maybaum used his Goldfinger screenplay as a model. Indeed, originally Diamonds Are Forever was to have pitted Bond against Goldfinger's identical twin brother, played by Gert Frobe. But that idea was rejected, and the villain changed to Ernst Stavro Blofeld, the head of Spectre, and his plan to blackmail the world. But the four early Bonds, plus On Her Majesty's Secret Service and License to Kill, have the grittiness of the Fleming novels. There is interest in content as well as style and execution. Speaking of executions, Oddjob is about to perform one on the unwitting Mr. Solo, played by British character actor Martin Benson. The name Solo created no end of problems for Saltzman and Broccoli and the NBC series The Man from U.N.C.L.E. In 1962, producer Norman Felton had begun a short-lived association with Fleming in a television series to have been called Solo, about a globe-trotting secret agent. Fleming worked on the project for a long time, but like his other television ventures, this one fell through, leaving him out of the production with nothing concrete remaining except for two names that Fleming had conceived, Napoleon Solo and April Dancer. Solo, as the Felton series was originally called, was eventually brought to the screen as a one-hour weekly adventure in the fall of 1964. Before it made it onto the air, however, Saltzman and Broccoli threatened to sue to get the name of the show changed, fearful that even the smallest connection with Fleming, still played up in its title, would damage their property. When the show rolled before audiences in September of 1964, it was called The Man from U.N.C.L.E. They need not have worried. As it turned out, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. not only didn't damage Bond, but, whetting audience, especially younger audience, appetites with its own stylish approach to adventure, it helped fuel the spy craze that suddenly flared around Goldfinger. Goldfinger opened in London on September 15, 1964, and in America on Christmas Day, and by the first week of 1965 was breaking box office records even as plans were made to reissue the first two Bonds. By January, there were theaters scheduling round-the-clock showings of Goldfinger to accommodate all of the people who wanted to see it, especially college students. It earned almost $3 million in under 2 weeks at 64 theaters spread among 41 cities, and saw total domestic film rentals of $23 million. Only Thunderball, at $28 million, outdid it at the box office among all of the Bonds. But now to Oddjob and his pressing engagement. These were actually among the very first scenes shot in the film, before production was formally underway. One of the reasons that Miami was chosen as locale was that in Europe there were no auto crushers that could take a complete car in the way that the crusher here does. As for Oddjob, he was played by a professional wrestler named Harold Sakata, who worked under the stage name Tosh Togo. Born the eldest of 10 children on the Hawaiian island of Kona, Sakata lifted weights as a youth to build himself up. It paid off in 1948 when he won a silver medal representing the United States in the Olympics in London. He's being doubled in these exterior shots. Editor Peter Hunt and designer Ken Adam recall this particular scene and some of the problems they encountered.
But actually, if you look under there, you could see through it. Because you could see that the engine had gone and there was a big hole as it went over you like that. And I optically had them fill it in. So that you couldn't see through it, so that you didn't know that the engine had gone. But originally, when they shot that shot, there was a hole there, and you could see that there was no engine in it. We put a bit of black over it, and they did it at the labs as an optical. And we couldn't spend a lot of time, of course. Obviously, it takes a little longer than that to get it to this size. But that's where we should have had a hat coming out of it. Right there. Just some wearing it. Or even just see a hand. Maybe some blood dripping from it. That's what you do today.
When we went through this crushing of the car, I've never seen a film unit react in such a way. This brand new Lincoln Continental ending up in a 4-foot square metal cube. The director, Guy Hamilton, wanted to shoot it all in one go. What we found out, and we had this little pickup truck, when I had the actual Lincoln go, you see how the pickup truck goes down with the weight of this. And I had to cut a lot out of it because otherwise the whole thing would have collapsed. So we had to stop the shooting and cut the cube to a manageable weight and size.
Cicada was spotted on television by Guy Hamilton in a pro wrestling match and approached about playing Odd Job. At first he was reluctant, afraid that Bond would toss him around the screen, which would have hurt his wrestling career. When he found out that he would do the tossing, he agreed. By all accounts, he was a very gentle man, who never forgot his impoverished childhood and contributed a lot to youth programs in his native Hawaii. And he went on to a very solid film and television career after Goldfinger. Indeed, he parodied his Odd Job character in a Vicks Formula 44 commercial as a cough sufferer who wrecks an entire apartment as his hacking causes him to splinter furniture with his hand. Cicada died of cancer in 1982. What is especially interesting about the scenes we've just been watching is the reactions that audiences originally had to them and to the entire movie. We've just seen at least 24 people, admittedly all mobsters, killed in ways that were unique to the screen at the time. Most gassings in movies took time for people to cough and suffer, so this was probably the first screen depiction of modern quick-acting nerve gas. Yet audiences, at least on one side of a line of demarcation, tended to think of Goldfinger as a fun movie, and it was a movie that children were brought to. One of the results of the enormous publicity campaign behind the picture, but surprising in view of its sexual imagery. But a certain minority of critics, mostly older, more conservative writers, took Goldfinger to task for its violence. This was particularly true in England, where Penelope Gilliatt, one of the most influential critics in the country, delineated Goldfinger's incidents of mayhem and questioned whether it would come to define movies of the 1960s. She was right. Goldfinger can be seen as a film that, at least as much as Hitchcock's Psycho, raised the acceptable level of screen violence through its well-placed comedy. Goldfinger, because of its outsized plot and popularity, was also the first of the Bonds to lend itself to extensive parody before the first of the Bond movies was even released. In 1962, the Harvard Lampoon published a miniature paperback called Alligator, a James Bond thriller by Ian Fleming. The artwork was a very subtle and funny parody of the old Signet paperback James Bond jackets, right down to the lettering design and the blurb on the back. Asterisks were used in place of the vowels in both Bond's and Fleming's names. The background blurb on Fleming on the back jacket opens with the declaration, "Ian Fleming is a spy. As a cover, he pretends to work for the British Diplomatic Corps." The authors tell the story of a hard-living, hard-loving, and utterly humorless British agent who comes up against Lacertus Alligator, the poor son of German immigrants who has made a fortune by smuggling alligators found in the New York City sewer system. What emerges from that smuggling case, which involves the agent in a 500,000-pound game of Go Fish, is that Alligator is actually the head of an international smuggling organization called Tooth, and his master plan is to steal the two houses of Parliament with their members and hold them for ransom. Alligator is a fascinating curiosity, but it was with the film Goldfinger that the film and television spy parodies took root in the 1960s pop culture. The most obvious was Get Smart, the Mel Brooks, Buck Henry satire, but there was also I Spy, the Flint movies with James Coburn, Charles K. Feldman's ill-advised Casino Royale, and at rock bottom, the Matt Helm movies starring Dean Martin. Curiously, Harry Saltzman produced what was probably the best cinematic offshoot of the espionage craze starred by Bond, the trilogy of The Ipcress File, Funeral in Berlin, and Billion Dollar Brain. All were based on books by Len Deighton and starred Michael Caine as reluctant British agent Harry Palmer, a far more cerebral and educated character than Fleming's James Bond. It is to Saltzman's credit, and that of Sidney J. Furie, Guy Hamilton, and Ken Russell, who directed the various entries in the series, that those films have endured better than any of the other rivals of James Bond. In retrospect, Goldfinger was the obvious flashpoint for the series. Gold itself is such a potent and alluring subject, and the villain and the story were just the right combination. Writer Richard Maybaum reflected on the potency of Goldfinger and the characters and imagery associated with it.
I wanted the villains all to be able to have give and take. Now, some of them were not able to do it, you see, and they weren't up to it as actors. But the ones that were the great ones could.
You know, in the book, the girl is not found painted gold until two-thirds of the way through the novel. It was just spoken about that he had painted one of the girls gold and she had died. But obviously that was so good that we had to stick that in right at the beginning. And can you imagine a beautiful girl like that painted gold? It was those kinds of things where we seized upon something that was notable and significant. Everything, as I said, in Goldfinger worked. Just worked. The whole business about Fort Knox and the, as I say, the changes we had to make that Mr. Fleming, you know, never figured out that it would take you 2 weeks to take that gold out of Fort Knox. So how do you not take anything away, break into Fort Knox and not take anything away? And why? And all that sort of stuff. It took some doing. And of course then when Bond hears it, he does it in 10 seconds. That shows you how smart Bond is. Took us weeks to figure out how we were going to get over this story impossibility, you see. Goldfinger, too, he was so much fun. That golf game and how he outwitted himself. And he was so pleased with himself and so childish at the same time. Goldfinger was really charming, you know. And then, of course, Anna Blackman, who in the book, I guess you'd call her a man-hater in the book. We made her absolutely impervious, and she said so as much. You can save your charm, Mr. Bondine. Immune. And that scene in the hay, that's, some people think that's the favorite scene in all Bond pictures. Bond and Pussy in the barn there, where she finally grabs him. It all came out the way we hoped it would.
Guy Hamilton.
Now let's both play.
I think this is one of the trickiest scenes in the movie. How to go from dyke to sex pot to heroin in the best of two falls, one submission, one roll in the hay. I suppose it comes off. After 19 weeks, principal photography came to an end. But there was one thing missing, only the aerial attack on Fort Knox. And with the release date of the picture 8 weeks away, a crisis was looming. Don't ask me why Bond movies had to open at the Odeon Leicester Square on September the 15th. Ready or not. Ted Moore and I left straight from the set, plane to Louisville, Kentucky, where Cubby was waiting for us. In 4 days, the three of us shot an amazing amount of material. Up from Goodman Airfield, sadly on a misty day, went Pussy Galore's Flying Circus. To fly the Piper Cubs, we'd assembled a gang of tough hombres, mostly dust-cropter pilots. They were all given black shirts and awful blonde nylon wigs from the local Woolworths. You'll notice I can never go in close on those planes. Once airborne, they insisted on removing the wigs. Too sissy. Those who kept them on could be seen with cigars clamped in their mouths. The law, of course, says that no plane may approach the depository less than 5,000 feet. Cubby's on the steps of the depository, quietening down the hysterical Zero Mostel brother-in-law as the formation zoomed 500 feet overhead.
Zero Mostel's brother-in-law, Victor Harkin, was the man in charge of the vault at Fort Knox. The Welcome General Rushon sign coming up refers to retired Air Force General Charles Rushon, who served as production liaison on the Bond movies beginning with From Russia with Love, continuing with Goldfinger, Thunderball, where he also played an Air Force officer, You Only Live Twice, and Live and Let Die. Guy Hamilton and Peter Hunt recall these sequences.
Adjacent to the depository is a vast army training camp. So next morning, Ted and I went up in a helicopter and made a series of swoops on soldiers attending instruction classes in the open air. Naturally, as we buzzed them, they all looked up. Every time we landed to reload the camera, ruder and ruder messages from the general commanding, ordering us to desist. We shot off in other directions as I tried to memorize all the locations. In the afternoon, with a most cooperative sergeant and his platoon of men, we retraced our steps to all the locations I could remember and try and find. Right now, all look up, please, and on my whistle, fall down dead. They all thought we were quite mad, but as we'd promised them beer and 20 bucks ahead, they soon got into the swing of things, and as we raced like blue-ass flies from one location to the next, trying to beat the setting sun. Right, all sit round this blackboard, look up, whistle, fall down dead, cut, thank you.
There were big problems on doing this because they were very nervous of Fort Knox. They don't normally allow planes to fly over Fort Knox, certainly not as low as that. And I think we nearly got into hot water over there. But we got the shot. It worked. John Barry did a marvelous score, as usual. By now, he got into the swing of it. The music is probably helping it all move along faster. I'm sure, because I used to say to him, don't drag my scenes out. I want them to move as fast as we can. And his music did a fine job. Again, you know, the importance of a good soundtrack. That is Pinewood Studios. There we are. Ken Adam built that. That's a bit of process. That's Pinewood Studios. That's a bit of process. That's Pinewood Studios. Good. So is that. You couldn't do that there. They would never allow you. That's the sort of road. It's an absolute replica of the road there. But yeah, this is all Pinewood Studios. This is all shot on the lot. I did some shooting around Fort Knox. Fort Knox was very interesting because they were nice people there, but they wouldn't let us go in. Nobody ever can get into Fort Knox except the official people, you know. They won't allow you. You drive up to a driveway where it says halt and state your business, and a big booming speaker yells at you, halt, state your business. And you have to say who you are and what your business is before you can go any further. And then you can only get as far as the gate. They won't let anybody come into Fort Knox at all or even look into it. They didn't even let Ken Adam. That was all his imagination, the whole of the interior of Fort Knox. Apart from some master shots of the actual Fort Knox, with the rest of it was all built on the back lot at Palmer Studios. The actual drive up to Fort Knox and the entrance and all that was done at Pinewood Studios, because they would never have let us do that out there at Fort Knox. I think I must be the only Englishman with a bank account at the Bank of Fort Knox. I've got $25 in the Bank of Fort Knox. Oh, it's gone up a bit by now, but still. Yeah, we had dinner one night with I think he was the governor, and I asked him, why won't you let us just take a look inside? What is there against just looking inside Fort Knox? And he said, I'll let you into a secret, he said. There's no gold there at all, that's why.
Since even the President of the United States is not allowed into Fort Knox, some apparently old congregational statute still on the books, presumably to ensure that the President doesn't remove a couple of gold ingots for his old age or to finance some re-election campaign, it was unlikely that we would be let in. This is exactly what happened. On the steps of the depository, the keeper of the vault, who turned out to be Zero Mostel's brother-in-law, he was courteous but firm, not even a little peek. The encounter turned into a Marx Brother routine as each of us in turn engaged him in conversation whilst the others snapped away behind his back. The photographs proved invaluable to rebuild the front of Fort Knox on the lot, and since no one knows what the interior of Fort Knox looks like, not even the President, Ken Adam could do his damnedest and who would contradict us? Obviously, the interior is like Sing Sing, a series of dark cells, each containing a few pallets of gold. But how dull. Definitely not Bondian. On looking at the Fort Knox sequence again, I think it stands up pretty well. All the elements are working together, the script is carefully paced to bring in each new surprise. The interior of Fort Knox isn't just an impressive set, but has been designed so that it works in storytelling terms. Where shall we put the elevator for maximum effect? Give me enough room for the Bond-Oddjob fight. Can you see the entrance doorway from down below? The balconies must jut out so that the stuntmen can do their falls. Where does Oddjob's hat get stuck? Are the bars wide enough? Etc., etc. Handcuffing Bond to the atom bomb is the classic snake pit situation which we were to develop into a fine art. How is Bond going to get out of this predicament? Audience, I'll give you 246 seconds to work it out. Now come on, hands up, first one get a guess. Since it took us probably 246 hours to figure it out, we were always onto a good thing. Later, Tom Mankiewicz and I had wonderful snake pit situations, but we had to abandon them because we could never find a satisfactory escape.
The finale is a quintuple payoff. Goldfinger cracks Fort Knox, a nuclear weapon and countdown are introduced, and then a shootout and the battle between Bond and Oddjob. Ken Adam talks about the sets.
I wasn't allowed inside. There I used that same laser to get through the rear entrance of Fort Knox. So what I did, I built the exterior of Fort Knox true to scale full size on the back lot of Pinewood. And the interior was a complete invention because, I mean, we built, for instance, we made these doors up all in wood, but faced with metal ply. And so I had the idea that since gold, in actual fact, is always kept in vaults and never stacked more than about 2 foot high because of its weight, I felt I had to depart from that completely and show the audience gold stacked up to the heavens, really. And that is when I used the whole size of a Pinewood stage, including, you know, building up to the gantry. And, you see, I stacked the gold up to about 36 feet in height and decided to put the gold behind the grill. And when I showed my first sketch to the producers, they thought I'd gone crazy because that looks like a prison. And I said, that's exactly the way I would like it to look. And then came up with the idea of that elevator, which is completely impractical because you would never transport gold that way. But it worked visually, and the proof was that after the film was released, United Artists, including myself, got something like 200 letters from all over the world saying, how were we allowed to shoot inside Fort Knox when the President of the United States hasn't got the right to visit the inside? It wasn't cheap, but, you know, by today's standard, it wasn't that expensive. I mean, the bonds became much more expensive later on with films like The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker when we went into space.
The fight between Oddjob and Bond that is now set up is one of the marvels of suspense cinema and represents the Bond movies at their best. All through the story, Fleming, Maybaum, and Dean have been setting up this confrontation, going out of their way to show how formidable Oddjob is. Now you've got a double race against time. The bomb is ticking, and Oddjob is trying to get to Bond before he can free himself from the handcuffs. And then the surprises come into play. The Bond movies, at least as written by Richard Maybaum, were an indirect outgrowth of Alfred Hitchcock on this level. Maybaum had worked with Hitchcock in 1940 on Foreign Correspondent, and he recalled in a New York Times article in 1964 one thing he learned from the English director. Hitchcock told him not to worry about continuity. What was important was if he had 13 bumps, he knew he had a picture. By bumps, he meant shocks, high points, and thrills. Maybaum took that concept to his Bond scripts, and the best of them have at least that many bumps. Indeed, this sequence has at least four, as Guy Hamilton relates.
The first time I saw the picture with an audience was at a sneak preview in Westwood Village in front of a packed house. Sitting in front of me was a red-necked loudmouth with his wife and mother-in-law. He was an authority on everything that was going on the screen and made sure that everybody around him knew it. He watched the Oddjob Bond fight intently. Couldn't figure out how Bond, being tossed around like a rag doll, was going to win. When suddenly Bond picks up Oddjob's hat. Our friend relaxed, he got it. Oddjob's going to be hoisted on his own petard, said he, and he leaned back smugly in his seat. I could have leant over and kissed him. He'd fallen into my carefully laid trap. I couldn't see his face as he leant forward again when Bond missed, but I had this insane sense of power, which is the joy of directing a Bond movie. You play with the audience, tease them. There are ground rules, of course, and they know them. You must play fair. But from then on, it's a great game, and it's up to you to play it to the hilt.
Peter Hunt.
We spent a long time shooting that special noise of that hat going through the air. We probably used a metal disc or something of that sort. Like a tin plate. It was only metallic when I did the inserts on it. I had to establish that the hat was metallic, otherwise it wouldn't have carried the electric current through there and electrocuted him. But in fact, the hat was not. It was just an ordinary hat. The greatest thing of all was having cast Sean Connery as James Bond, who really was a very sexy man. There are very few characters, very few film stars, actors, whatever, who have that sort of quality. I guess Clark Gable had it, and there must be one or two others who had it. But, I mean, you know, they virtually can walk into a room and fuck anybody. And that's the great ability of his sexy charm, I suppose, that he has with women particularly. He has tremendous eyes and a good face, nose, and structure of his bone structure of his face is tremendous. He's grown exactly like his father. I remember his father used to come down to the set on occasions. And Sean, as he is now, is exactly like his father. Father was an older, handsome Scotsman. Harry Saltzman always managed to put his finger on areas that he didn't feel were right, that you had to search and look for, and you really often found, most of the time found, that there was something that you could put right. And he was right on this countdown that it should have stopped on 007. That was his idea. We didn't do it originally. It didn't occur to me at all when I shot the inserts. I went back and did another bit of insert, made it stop at 007. Because Harry screamed and said, oh, it should stop at 007. Well, of course it should, that's right.
What kept you?
You okay, James? Where's your butler friend?
Oh, he blew a fuse.
The line, he blew a fuse, is a bit of symmetry provided by Maybaum and Dean, the equivalent to the line shocking at the end of the pre-credit sequence. By now, however, the audience is in on the fun. The line is really a sort of false lead, marking where we came in, and the picture settles down sedately with a few loose ends left, such as where is Goldfinger and what happened to Pussy Galore, to be tied up. Pictures weren't supposed to do this to audiences, wrenching them around in quite this way, although From Russia with Love had its false ending as well. This part of the picture, depicting Bond's ride aboard a special plane to meet the President, really a redressed version of Mr. Goldfinger's private plane, is deliberately flat so that Hamilton, Steers, and company can work their magic once again on the audience. Tell them what you're going to do and do it. The depiction of explosive decompression coming up in this sequence is the most realistic done on the screen until this time. There had been a few pictures about aviation, such as The Crowded Sky, that tried to show what happens when a plane decompresses at altitude, but the Bond special effects team deserves real credit for this rather terrifying moment, which wasn't surpassed until 1970 when Universal's original Airport showed a fully loaded passenger jet losing its pressurized atmosphere. In the book, of course, Oddjob is sucked out of the plane while Goldfinger is strangled in his fight with Bond. On a literary level, this was a fine idea, the strangling or suffocation of Goldfinger being just recompense for his murder of Jill Masterson by skin suffocation. But the movie needed something more visually dazzling, especially after the multitude of exotic deaths depicted in the rest of the picture, crushings, gassings, electrocution, and of course being painted to death. Peter Hunt tells how this harrowing series of illusions and effects were created in the studio.
I shot the whole going out of the plane, which was great fun, actually. And it had to be done, if you watch it, that I shot, and that, all those stuff, you see, and all that of him going away and flying down there like that. You see, it's all done with, oop, you never really see him go through that window. But you do, but the illusion is there. We put him on wires down the fuselage of the plane. This was the plane, the interior of the plane, of course, that Ken built. And that's all on wires, you see. Look, he's hanging out there on wires. They're pulling his feet because they're out of camera. And there he is hanging on wires. And then I put everything else on wires, the cushions and all the bits that can move, and then blew all the papers with a very strong wind machine. It was a very tedious sequence to do, but it worked when we got it all done. It worked. And this, it was in keeping with almost the unbelievability of the sequences.
No, no,
A few words about the end credits of Goldfinger. As originally released, they announced that James Bond would return in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and as late as the fall of 1964, Broccoli and Saltzman intended that book, generally regarded as the best of Fleming's novels, to be the next movie. But a complication had arisen when Kevin McClory, a filmmaker who had collaborated with Fleming on the screenplay to Thunderball in the 1950s, won his lawsuit in a London court and was awarded all screen rights to Thunderball. This was something that Broccoli and Saltzman had feared all along, that one of the few Fleming Bond titles that they didn't control, such as Casino Royale, would go into production while they were making their pictures. McClory originally intended to mount his own production but couldn't raise financing or find a suitable James Bond, and a deal was struck by which Saltzman and Broccoli's company would produce Thunderball with McClory as executive producer. Thus, On Her Majesty's Secret Service was pushed back, and Thunderball became the next movie in the series. This is Bruce Eder, hoping you've enjoyed this special edition of Goldfinger. I'd like to thank Peter Hunt, Guy Hamilton, Ken Adam, and Richard Maybaum for their participation in this project, and Honor Blackman and Terrence Young for their kind assistance.